The Ark of Millions of Years, Chapter 17, The Lost Civilization of Mu. According to legends, the first civilization arose on the temporal Earth about 78,000 years ago on a large landmass that was divided into three large islands. Australia was the southernmost island mass. Supposedly, the Pacific Islands are the remaining mountain peaks of the two other lost island lands. The Great Lemurian Empire may have comprised the Fiji Islands, Hawaii, Easter Island, and some of the Los Angeles area. Nostradamus speaks of a land which he refers to as the Eye of the Sea. He also refers to a land which he designates as the Aquatic Triplicity. Australia, New Guinea, and Tasmania are all geologically part of one piece of continental shelf, and could also be the Triple Island Complex. The region was a tropical paradise, described much like the Garden of Eden. It was called Mu, or Lemuria, but sometimes referred to as Pan, or Rutas, Hiva, and Pacifica. In 1860, a group of British geologists noted similarities between the strata of the Permian Age in India, South Africa, Australia, and South America. Identical fossils of land plants and land animals were also found in these strata from the different continents. Geologists postulated the existence of a former land bridge in even continents that had long ago sunk beneath the oceans to explain their findings in the similarity of the strata. Ernest Heinrich Haeckler used the hypothetical land bridge in his theory to explain the distribution of lemurs in Africa, India, Madagascar, and the Malaysian Peninsula. He theorized that a land bridge once extended long enough above water to allow lemurs to spread into these regions. This land bridge was named Lemuria by an English biologist, Philip L. Sculter, because of the theorized association with lemurs. Later, better theories explaining the similarities of the strata and fossils arose. It became clear that land bridges and sunken continents never really existed, but the name Lemuria has stuck and been forever applied as another name for Mu, or correctly, Muror. The well-known modern occultist, Madame Blavatsky, reincarnated Lemuria as a lost continent. She claimed to have learned of the existence of Lemuria in a book titled The Book of Xian, which was supposed to have been composed in Atlantis and shown to her by the Mahatmas. Sanskrit legends tell of a former continent named Rutus that sank beneath the sea long ago in the Indian Ocean, that obviously she became confused with. However, she did give recognition to Philip Sculter for inventing the name of Lemuria. Occultists have developed all kinds of tales about Lemurians, who were like thought projections and not physically solid. They came to Earth to experience the physical vibration and were androgynous, neither male nor female. Some chose water, some chose the plant kingdom, some the mineral kingdom, and some the animal kingdom to project into and experience that reality. They were interdimensional souls that used the rainbow spectrum as a window to move between realities. In the latter part of the 19th century, when all manner of occult and theosophical speculation was rampant, along came the Anglo-American explorer James Churchward, who later called himself Colonel, published during the 1920s and 1930s five main volumes of the Mu series. These popular books were The Lost Continent of Mu, The Children of Mu, The Sacred Symbols of Mu, The Cosmic Forces of Mu, and The Second Book of the Cosmic Forces of Mu. It is by studying various ancient texts and tablets that explorer James Churchward claims to have discovered the existence of a long-lost continent with an advanced civilization called the Empire of the Sun. This empire, over time, gradually sunk below the Pacific Ocean in stages, starting about 26,000 years ago, following a cataclysmic event. The following is quoted from his first book of the Mu series, Nile or Euphrates Valley, but from this now submerged continent, Mu, the motherland of man. From various records, it would seem that this continent consisted of three separate lands, divided from each other by narrow seas or channels. But where or how these divisions were made by nature, there is nothing to show, except possibly an Egyptian hieroglyph, which represents three long, narrow lands running east to west. The land of Mu was half of the Pacific Ocean. Churchward describes the land of Mu as follows. It was a beautiful tropical country with vast plains. The valleys and plains were covered with rich grazing grasses and tilled fields, while the low rolling hill lands were shaded by luxuriant growths of tropical vegetation. No mountains or mountain ranges stretched themselves through this earthly paradise, for mountains had not yet been forced up from the bowels of the earth. The great rich land was intersected and watered by many broad, slow-running streams and rivers, which wound their sinuous ways in fantastic curves and bends around the wooded hills and through the fertile plains. Luxuriant vegetation covered the whole land with soft, pleasing, restful mantle of green. Bright and fragrant flowers on tree and shrub added coloring and finish to the landscape. The tall, fronded palms fringed the ocean's shores and lined the banks of the rivers for many a mile inland. Great feathery ferns spread their long arms out from the riverbanks. In valley places where the land was low, the rivers broadened out into shallow lakes, around whose shores myriads of sacred lotus flowers dotted the glistening surface of the water like vari-colored jewels in settings of emerald green. Over the cool rivers, gaudy winged butterflies hovered in the shade of the trees, rising and falling in fairy-like movements as if better to view their painted beauty in nature's mirror. Darting hither and thither from flower to flower, hummingbirds made their short flights, glistening like living jewels in the rays of the sun. Feathered songsters in bush and tree vied with each other in their sweet lays. The chirpings of lively crickets filled the air, while above all other sounds came those of the locust as he industrially ground his scissors, telling the whole world all was well with him. Roaming through the primeval forests were herds of mighty mastodons and elephants, flapping their big ears to drive off annoying insects. The great continent was teeming with gay and happy life over which 64 million human beings reigned supreme. All this life was rejoicing in its luxuriant home. Churchward continues in the lost continent of Mu. The dominant race of the lands of Mu was a white race, exceedingly handsome people with clear white or olive skins, large, soft, dark eyes, and straight black hair. Besides this white race, there were other races, people with yellow, brown, or black skins. These ancient inhabitants of Mu were great navigators and sailors who took their ships over the world from the eastern to the western oceans and from the northern to the southern seas. And the land of Mu was the mother and the center of the earth's civilization, learning, trade, and commerce. All other countries throughout the world were her colonies or colonial empires. We continue on with another excerpt taken from the lost continent of Mu. That they were nine upon nine saw the great high temple of Mu built, each stone, each inner part was of them. Then they rested from their work and waited for the great Ra of Mu to to come in his golden ship and anchor atop the temple. Lo, the high Ra Mu, religious leader of the sun, called forth unto Nine the priest. And he called unto Nine the priestess. These of the order of the phoenix were to each send their nine outward in every direction of the hub. They journeyed to North America, South America, the moon nation, the nation of the Nile. Like a giant spider web, they covered the land, and great temples were built, and in them were placed light and knowledge. The sacred writing of the motherland, which was carried by the Nakals, holy brothers, to Mu's colonies throughout the world 70,000 years or more ago, is the oldest written information about the origin of Freemasonry. The extreme age of the Brotherhood is not only attested by the sacred writings, but by various Oriental writings, inscriptions, and prehistoric Mexican stone tablets, which are, as shown by some of them, over 12,000 years old. Quoting from the Lhasa record of Tibet, Churchward continues, "When the star of Baal, or Baal, fell on the place where now is only the sky and sea, the seven cities with their golden plates and transparent temples quivered and shook like the leaves in a storm. And behold, a flood of fire and smoke arose from the palaces. Agonies and cries of the multitude filled the air. They sought refuge in their temples and citadels. Twice Mu jumped from her foundations. It was then sacrificed by fire. It burst while being shaken up and down violently by earthquakes. The land was rended and torn to pieces, quivering like the leaves of a tree in a storm, rising and falling like the waves in the ocean. And during the night, it went down." While serving as an officer in the British Army in India in 1868, Colonel Churchward befriended a high priest of an Indian temple. The old priest found him to be a seeker of ancient knowledge and eventually allowed Churchward to access some ancient tablets that had been preserved for nearly 50,000 years. These tablets were only a few fragments of what had been once a vast collection that was rescued from one of the old seven Rishi cities, which were the centers of learning in the Rama Empire in ancient India. Over the full course of 2 years, the old priest taught Churchward how to decipher the bas-relief characters upon the clay tablets. These tablets had been written either in Burma, or perhaps even in Mu itself, by the ancient Nakal priests. After many months of study, Churchward discovered that the tablets described in detail the creation of the earth and of the appearance of man on a continent in the Pacific called the Land of Mu. Supposedly, he learned as well from the texts of an ancient migration of Nakal priests who left Mu to establish a colony in India. When he fully realized the enormous significance of his discovery, Churchward set off to Burma in hopes of finding more of the tablets. There, the Buddhist priests told him to go back to India because their tablets, with all their priceless information, had been stolen and carted off to India by thieves. The angry priest then spat at Churchward's feet and quickly walked away. Undaunted, Churchward became obsessed with finding proof of the amazing story. He studied all the writings of the ancient civilizations of the old world and compared them with the tablets on Mu he had deciphered. He discovered that they were all preceded by the civilization of Mu. For the next 45 to 50 years of his life, he became determined to find proof of the actual existence of Mu. Churchward offers proof, firstly, via the Nakal tablets. Your authors note that apparently no one else has ever seen these tablets to document or verify that they even exist. He mentions records written in Mayan, Egyptian, and Indian, which recount the destruction of Mu. He quotes, "When the earth's crust was broken up by earthquake and then sank into a fiery abyss, when the waters of the Pacific rolled in over her, leaving only water where a mighty civilization had existed." He makes references to the Mayan Trawana manuscript and to yet another Mayan book as old as the Trawano manuscript called the Codex Cortesianus, which according to him makes mention of the land of Mu. Again, your authors note that these manuscripts translate differently and that no mention of Mu is found anywhere in these writings. The following is taken from an online educational library. The Madrid Codex was originally identified as two separate manuscripts of unequal lengths, called the Manuscript Trawano and the Codex Cortesianus. The two parts were identified as elements of one codex and were reunited in 1892. The original Madrid Codex is now housed in the Museo de America in Madrid and is sometimes referred to as the Codex Trocortesianus. The leaves displayed show a portion of the almanac section used by priests to perform divination rites relating to daily activities such as hunting, weaving, and agriculture. The lower half of the panel is composed of glyphs of the 20 named days, which, as in the Aztec calendar, cycle 13 times through the 260-day sacred year. Sky serpents that send the rain and speak of thunder are shown weaving around the rows of glyphs. Circles with a crosshatch design drawn on the bodies of the serpents symbolize Chichag, the fifth of the 20 named days, perhaps associating that name day with rain gods or rain ceremonies. In leaf 16, a death god is depicted, wearing his characteristic death eyes in a collar, as well as at his wrists and ankles. The glyph just above and to the right of his head is the symbol for both death and the sixth named day, Simi. Day glyph is the third glyph down from the second column from the right. If a priest reading the codex for divination purposes arrives at this symbol, it is considered an omen of death or illness. Just above the Simi glyph is the symbol for Imix, the first of the 20 named days, an auspicious sign of abundance when reading portents. Above and to the right of the god, resting on the red horizontal line, is the maize god. He holds in his hand the sign of Khan, symbolizing both maize and the fourth day, on top of which appears the Imix glyph. In leaf 17, two rain gods called Chax, one is upside down, are above the rows of glyphs. This name is the same Mayan name of lay priest called Chax, under special priests called Nakons, and regular priests called Chilans. The Mayan civilization reached its zenith by 200 AD and inexplicably declined about 600 AD. From the above translation, it appears the church word had an overactive imagination, as the above text contains primarily astrological and calendrical dates. He fails to mention by name what the other records from Egypt, Greece, Central America, and Mexico were. He mentions, whilst at Uxmal in the Yucatan, there is an inscription upon an ancient ruined pyramid which commemorates the lands of the west whence we came, and a pyramid southwest of Mexico City, according to its inscriptions, in memory of the destruction of these lands of the west. Again, one of your authors has visited these sites and as far as I know, these inscriptions do not exist. Churchward cites the Lhasa record as speaking of seven principal cities, which were the seats of religion, science, and learning in Mu, scattered across the three lands. Once more, your authors want to remind the readers that no one has ever seen the supposed Lhasa record outside of Churchward to document its existence. So have your authors debunked the theory of the lost civilization of Mu? Well, maybe not. When you discard all the previous writings on Mu in this chapter, there still remains all the legends that abound in Australia, the South Pacific, Polynesia, and Asia, that this land once existed, and it was the place where man first appeared, and that it was destroyed in a cataclysm. One thing is absolutely obvious and undeniable. There are pyramids, and pyramid-like structures, in every corner of the world. They are made of sandstone, adobe, granite, and fashioned out of mounds. They have roughly the same religious purpose and are the center of all leadership for those cultures. They span in time from about 10,500 BC to at least 600 AD. Their involvement with the origin and eternal life of man is evident in the record of the cultures that built them, or perhaps more importantly, inherited them. Some anthropologists would have you believe that this was a result of traveling explorers who came across a land bridge to the extents of the earth. The choice for the reader is to contemplate the possibility that they are all wrong. The Aborigines and many Southwest Indian tribes speak of this place as the dream time, or the first time period. Your authors feel that where there is smoke, there is usually fire. Is there any surviving evidence today that can validate Churchward's claims that these lands once existed? Perhaps there is. First, these three island lands were located in a highly unstable region, surrounded by the area called the Ring of Fire in the Pacific Ocean. We prefer to call two of them island lands and not continents, but recognizing that Australia is a continent. Because two of the island lands were probably close to Australia, Churchward may have assumed they were part of the same continent, thus calling all of this land mass the continent of Mu. This would certainly explain the size of Mu, described by Churchward as being 5,000 miles from east to west, and over 3,000 miles from north to south. He writes, "The continent consisted of three areas of land, divided from each other by narrow channels or seas." Although it is not unreasonable to believe that perhaps Australia at one time had connecting land masses, separated only by narrow channels, supposedly, about 50,700 BC, there was a cataclysm that sunk a portion of the lowlands of a landmass that bordered southern California. Then, 24,000 BC, another island sank beneath the ocean after volcanic eruptions and severe earthquakes. Finally, in 9500 BC, a final cataclysm nearly destroyed the earth and buried the last of this immense landmass beneath the Pacific Ocean. Since this is an earthquake-prone region where tectonic plates rub against each other, setting off volcanic activity, this certainly adds some credence to Churchward's story. Was the continent of Mu the cradle of civilization where man first appeared? It certainly would have been the ideal location, with a tropical climate, broad, flat plains watered by slow rivers and streams, luxuriant vegetation and teeming with varieties of animals, birds, and fowl. Churchward compares the land as to the Garden of Eden. Doesn't the maternal mitochondrial DNA study say that man came out of Africa? Yes, it does. But it doesn't say when. Early hominids could have walked out of Africa and colonized parts of the world before the appearance of modern man. So, whence cometh man? There is a preponderance of evidence that dispels the modern tradition that man evolved simultaneously in distant corners of the world. In fact, the truth that the modern race of man has a common origin, or at least a single point of contact between two races of man, we maintain as undeniable. There is a common thread of belief in a pre-existence, a mortal growth or probationary state, and an unshakable belief in eternal life. In every instance, the soul received a higher glory as it associates itself with one Creator God while in mortal life. Your authors are now going to present what we found in the ancient writings and scriptures on this very controversial subject. First, remember that there were two creations, the spiritual creation and temporal creation. Adam, the first man, was created directly out of the spiritual dust of the spiritual earth by God the Father. The Zohar, or Book of Splendor, has many references to the upper Adam. It refers to a lower Adam as well. The temporal earth was created by God the Son and other spiritual beings under the direction of His Father. The temporal creation was brought forth differently than that of the spiritual creation. However, the temporal creation is patterned after the spiritual creation. The temporal account of the creation is given in Genesis 1. Note that humans were created after the other animals. And God made the beast of the earth after His kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after His kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, Let us make man in our image. So God created man in His own image. Incidentally, you should note that in Genesis 1, chapter 27, the first man and woman were created simultaneously. So God created man in His own image. In the image of God created He him. Male and female created He them. The spiritual account of the creation is given in Genesis 2. And you'll note that the first man was given a name, Adam, and was created before the other animals. And the Lord God said, It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an helpmeet for him. And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to all cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found an helpmeet for him. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof, and the rib which the Lord God had taken from the man made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. In a brief review, it is important that we grasp clearly one idea. Originally, man was created in the image of God, the Father, who was a spiritual being. The first man, Adam, the upper Adam, was a spiritual entity or soul. The temporal creation was, however, a different creation. The first man, lower Adam, was a physical or temporal entity that was made by God. The Son and other spiritual beings, after having evolved to a certain point, he was made into a new creature, having already existed. He was perfected physically to look like his creators and given a soul. The word create means to bring into being or existence, and the word made, a past tense of the word make, means to construct. Man on this planet, the temporal creation, was remade or constructed, having already existed. He was patterned after the upper Adam when he was given a soul and made to look physically like his creators. Let me summarize. To create is to bring something into existence. To make is to construct something from material already existing. The upper Adam was created. The lower Adam was made. Isn't it amazing how definitions of the simple words create, make, and made changed the whole meaning of texts? So similar, yet profoundly different when analyzed. Religious leaders have reasoned that the two contradictory creation accounts were the result of two different authors who wrote as they perceived the creation and placed each of their similar but different accounts in Genesis. But once the concept of the two creations is understood, then the two accounts of the creation in Genesis make perfect sense. Now, the timing is the subject of much disagreement, but there are two main themes that permeate every known religion that involves the origin of man. One theme is that a race of man was created on the temporal earth and was allowed to proliferate much like any other creation, except with superior intellect. Tools, pottery, clothing, tombs, and communities of evidence can substantiate his existence many thousands of years prior to the great flood mentioned in the history of every ancient religion. He migrated, he hunted, and in many cases farmed and domesticated animals. The other theme presented in every cultural religion is that there was a spiritual creation of man. This man was highly intelligent, strong, and genetically pure. He also had a soul and an inextricable link to one Creator God from the very beginning. A grand separation occurred between those that held to their divine nature and those who did not. The faithful and pure survived, and at some point in time, one of the main purposes of your authors, we intend to contribute the idea that the temporal and spiritual races came together here on this planet. The results changed everything in the universe. The Sefer Yetzirah, or the Book of Creation, states that God allowed the universe to develop by itself, the temporal universe after its initial creation. All the laws of nature and the properties of matter had been fixed for all time, as it is written. He has established them forever. He has made a decree which shall not be transgressed. It is similarly written, whatever God decrees shall be forever. Nothing shall be added to it, and nothing shall be taken away. Around some 25,000 years ago, man developed all the physical and mental capabilities that we possess today. This man had evolved from the dust of the earth, temporal earth, but he still lacked the divine soul that would make him a spiritual being. God then created Adam, the lower Adam, the first true human being with a soul on the temporal earth, and he blew in his nostrils a soul of life. This ancient book with rabbinical interpretation states that man evolved from the dust of the earth. This could mean that he evolved, just as scientists say, from an early branch of the primate family who evolved also from the dust of the earth. The Zohar speaks of early man having ape-like characteristics. Apparently, certain laws were put forth on this temporal planet to allow things to come forth or evolve by themselves without further interference, except when necessary. When the man-like creatures had evolved to a certain point, then God the Son, along with other spiritual beings, made a new being with a soul, which was in their image. It is the same process that God the Son has done in countless other worlds in this temporal universe that he created. There is an ancient Babylonian text that gives a good description of how the temporal man may have been made, called Atrahasis. It was written no later than 1700 BC. In essence, the god Anu and Enlil, his son, called a great meeting of the gods and goddesses. Enlil addressed the meeting to try and avert a rebellion that one is led to assume that it may have been Enki, Enlil's brother. Now, Anu, having defeated the god Alalu, was the supreme ruler of some of the gods and the Anunnaki, fallen angels, or watchers. The Anunnaki were also present at the meeting and complained of the heavy workload that they had to bear. Enki spoke up, saying that he had a solution. While the birth goddess is present, let her create Lulu, man. Let him bear the yoke. Let man carry the toil of the gods. Enki's suggestion was unanimously accepted, and the gods voted to create the worker. Man shall be his name, they said. Enlil called upon Mami, Ninhursag is another name, his sister, to help in man's creation. Enlil said to her, "You are the birth goddess. Create workers." She said that it is not possible for her to make things, but that she would need the skilled help of Enki. The story depicts Enki as a chief scientist among the gods who is learned in the science of genetics. The text continues with the slaying of the god Weilu, a god who has intelligence, from whom man was to gain intelligence. Enki and Mami, the mother goddess, created man from clay and from the flesh and blood of the slain god. From his flesh and blood, let Nintu, Mami, mix clay, that god and man may be thoroughly mixed in the clay. Let there be a spirit from the god's flesh. A surrogate mother was needed for the birth process. Enki offered the childbearing service of his own wife, the goddess Ninki. "Ninki, my goddess spouse, will be the one for labor. 7 goddesses of birth will be near to assist." In a hospital-like place called the House of Destiny, the gods were waiting for the procedure and birth to take place. Finally, success was achieved, and the birth of the first Lulu, or man, took place. There is a well-known cylinder seal from ancient Mesopotamia showing a laboratory with flasks, a burner, and the god Enki holding a test tube. Mami is shown mixing a concoction on a burner, and the goddess Ninki is shown presenting Adam to Enki. The Aztec creation of mankind. Quetzalcoatl descended to the underworld to obtain from its ruler, Mitzlantecuhtli, bones and ashes of the previous generation of humanity, from which to recreate, remake man. Quetzalcoatl delivers his precious cargo to the gods assembled in Tamoanchan. Tamoanchan is the place of creation and origin of man. It is the Aztec Garden of Eden. Ihuacuatl and Quetzalcoatl grind the bone fragments into a mass and place them into a precious vessel. The gods then perform auto-sacrifice, permitting their blood to drip thickly on the mass of ground-up bones. After 4 days, a male child emerges, and after 4 more days, a female infant emerges. There are several other Mesopotamian and similar creation myths worldwide that speak of the gods mixing their blood with clay or pulverized bones from the preceding generation even using the flesh of a sacrificed god to create man. Perhaps this was one way to convey to man that he was a special divine creation. As we, the authors, view the above early texts, it would seem that early man evolved to a certain point, and then the gods came down and genetically re-engineered him into their image. Whether this process took days, years, or thousands of years to accomplish matters little, as time is of no particular essence to the gods on the temporal creation. They measure time in the greater eternal perspective. Essentially, this is what is conveyed in Genesis chapter 1 in the temporal creation account. We'll read again. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Man had already evolved to a certain point, but lacked the image of the gods. The Sefer Yetzer refers to them as soulless beings. Early hominids may have evolved directly from the dust, and not as an early offshoot and descendant of the primates, because kinds of one animal do not evolve into other kinds. However, they could possibly be genetically re-engineered. So early hominids could have evolved directly from the dust, or descended from an early offshoot of the primates, who may have also evolved from the dust. Either way, the early hominid was not fully human until the gods intervened. The following statements are taken from a website, parentcompany.com. The currently hot evidence for human evolution comes from molecular biology. The DNA molecules or genes of different species are compared, and particular protein molecules are likewise compared. The more similar are the sequences of nucleotide units in the DNA molecules, and the more similar are the sequences of amino acid units in the protein molecules. The closer the evolutionary relationship is assumed to be. There are problems with this theory of DNA and protein evolution, however. Different proteins sometimes give different results from each other and from DNA. For example, the cytochrome C molecules of man are identical to that of chimpanzee, but differ by one amino acid from that of the rhesus monkey, considerably more distant from man, but chimp still quite close. In fact, it has been said that chimp DNA is as much as 99% similar to human DNA. But then it is reasonable to ask why there is so much difference between chimps and humans. It appears that DNA may not determine everything after all. One thing certain is that DNA comparisons do not prove evolution. What appears to be clearly confirmed is that many forms of humanoid creatures lived thousands and even millions of years ago, both giants and dwarfs. The bones of Gigantopithecus, discovered in 1946, date back nearly 10 million years. This giant stood more than 8 feet tall and weighed 400 to 500 pounds. Ramapithecus, an ancient primate, was small, only a few feet high. It is now thought that both these possible missing links are an evolutionary side branch and were contemporary with our true ancestor. Current scientific opinion is that a primate named Australopithecus, or Lucy, is the best candidate for a direct ancestor of man. This species dates back nearly 4 million years. About 115,000 years ago, modern Homo sapiens appeared abruptly on the fossil record. While clearly a derivative of archaic Homo sapiens, the change is sudden. Archaic Homo sapiens is a derivative of Homo erectus. Modern Homo sapiens appeared on the scene before the more primitive Neanderthal man, who are the further natural evolution of Homo erectus. The fossil record supports the belief that modern Homo sapiens were indeed a special creation and did not evolve naturally from primitive forms, because his appearance on the scene was sudden. In summary, the ancient texts and fossil records indicate that early hominids in the temporal creation either evolved from the dust or descended from a very early primate branch, who also evolved from the dust. It appears that the gods came about 115,000 years ago and genetically improved or re-engineered archaic Homo sapiens into modern Homo sapiens, who were made into a new creation patterned after their image, patterned after the gods. Therefore, the evolutionists are correct in stating that man on the temporal earth evolved, and the creationists are also correct in their belief that man was made. Modern man was an evolved, genetically re-engineered, special new creation on the temporal earth. He was both. And the most amazing realization is that we have had the answer to the creationism versus evolution all along in the biblical scriptures. The meaning and use of the words create, make, and made being hidden in plain view in the Genesis creation texts. Now, as to the matter of the races. There are legends that still prevail in Central America, South America, and in southwestern Native American tribes that the gods created four different races in their own image in various parts of the world at the same time. Their belief was that the red race was created in the Americas, the yellow race in Asia, the blue or black race in Africa, and the white race in Europe. Each race represents one of the four divine cosmic forces as elements. The red race, earth elements. Blue race, fire elements. White race, air elements. And the yellow race, water elements. The Zohar states that race is the product of the environment, which is dependent on location, sunlight, food, air, and availability of outside marriages for genetic diversity. Genetics definitely play a role in the different ways people appear. For example, Native Americans have a gene that puts their capillary blood vessels close to the skin surface that gives them a red cast or coloration. Orientals have a gene that put a layer of fat just under the skin that provides a yellow coloration. The amount of skin pigment or melanin determines how dark or light a person's skin's complexions will be. It is really all in the inherited genes, and there is a great variety of genetic diversity among men and animals. Scientists today feel that there are no distinct races of people because there is diversity of color and traits even within a race. Race was known only on the temporal creation. We will probably never know for sure on the issue of race. Environment definitely is a factor, producing genetic diversity, but whether the gods created the races is speculative at most. Meanwhile, back to Mu. Just suppose that Mu, as the South Pacific legends say, it is the motherland or cradle of civilization. Could not early hominids have migrated out of Africa by crossing land bridges that may have connected Africa to Australia in remote times when sea levels were much lower? Once arriving in Australia, they found the continent and close, fertile island lands offshore of Australia a desirable place to live, a sort of Garden of Eden on this planet. Then, about 115,000 years ago, the gods God, the Son, and other spiritual beings came to the island paradise and re-engineered them into a new creation that looked like them in every respect. It is not unreasonable to think that cataclysms made it necessary for one or more major migrations from Mu to cross existing land bridges back into Africa, Asia, and Europe. Isn't it much more likely that the reason all these cultures have common symbols and workings in their religions and architectures is that they have a common origin at Mu? The commonality is irrefutable. Each year, the evidence grows that anciently there was a very modern and mobile civilization here on this planet. Their knowledge was astounding. Their goodness and benevolence was greater than anything modern man has achieved. Unfortunately, their evil was also as proportionately astounding. The advent of this knowledge was sudden and profound. There is only one explanation for which any evidence remains. This knowledge was brought in from somewhere else by an extremely advanced and purposed source. Once modern man began to multiply, the rebel fallen angels came to corrupt the seed of men on this planet on orders from Lucifer. They found the daughters of these men to be fair, seduced them, and they bore giant offspring. The rebel watchers, fallen angels, or Nephilim, also called the elder gods, were super intelligent beings, fallen sons of God. They coexisted with men, teaching man all manners of science, farming, art, music, writing, maritime skills and boat building and navigation, medicine, metalworks, and architecture. Man viewed them as their gods, worshipped and paid them tribute. Ancient writings, hieroglyphics, and archaeological evidence support this very well. Even Buddha claims in his writings that he associated with the elder gods. Man was a willing worker for his gods. These off-worlders were capable of such wickedness. Many of the watchers deliberately taught them sexual immorality, vanity, murder, mayhem, war, and idolatry. They were also perhaps in an effort to redeem themselves with lifetimes of good works after their abominations, capable of incredible good and glorious technology, which some freely shared with their subjects. Together, the watchers and man developed a highly civilized and intellectual civilization that eventually spread colonies into South America and colonized other parts of the world across the oceans. Although Mu has been portrayed as a peaceful society governed by laws and regulations, sexual perversions and immorality were standard everyday fare that was not only permitted, but expected as normal. For example, the giant offspring practiced sodomy. To be chosen to be sodomized by one of them was considered an honor. To refuse was to suffer the retribution of dishonor. It is an obvious and purposeful deviation from the procreative functions of the human body. It was used by the followers of the Order of Cain to consummate a covenant to commit murder for personal gain and an initiatory rite for entrance into secret combinations of evil practiced by the Nicolaitanes and Gadianton robbers. The name is derived from the city of Sodom that was destroyed by God in the Old Testament for completely corrupting the act of copulation. The practice has been determined to be one of the most medically unsafe acts that one human can perform with another. The transfer of disease is so efficient that of those people that regularly practice sodomy, only 2% on average live long enough to collect Social Security. According to Churchward, South America looked different in those days prior to the cataclysm. The Andes were mere hills, and there was a large inland lake or sea that filled most of the area of northern South America with an open channel or river to the Atlantic. Tiahuanaco was first built on the western rim of this island inland sea and was a major seaport. By 10,000 BC, well-established colonies were in parts of South America. The Nephilim, or elder gods, and their giant offspring were said to be the builders of Tiahuanaco in Bolivia when the site of the original city was at sea level. In addition, legends say that they were the builders of the 26 stone cities of Akakor. It is further said that the Empire of the Sun, evidently, had an emperor who acted as a figurehead for their solar deity, whose symbol was the sun. This emperor bore the title of Ra-Mu, and he presided over a group of priests called the Nakals. Lemuria sent high priests called the Nakals, or Holy Brotherhood, to various colonies to teach their doctrines and preserve writings of the history of this planet and knowledge. Science and religion were covered as one subject. The colony of Nakals officiated in the great Temple of the Sun in Tiahuanaco. It was a solar brotherhood that became better known as the Great White Brotherhood on Earth. It was called a white brotherhood not because of the race, but because they believed themselves to be spiritually enlightened, the color white being associated with spirituality. At one time, a great golden sun disc, encrusted with precious gems, hung in the Temple of the Sun. The disc had the image of a man's face in the center, with seven light rays radiating from around the golden orb that represented the sun. Several copies of the golden sun disc were placed in other temples, the original being in the Temple of the Sun in Mu. According to legend, members of the Nakal Brotherhood left Mu for Egypt, Burma, India, Tibet, and Atlantis about 30,000 years ago. In the Hindu epic of Ramayana, Valmiki mentions the Nakals as having arrived in Burma from the lands to the east. Rutas appeared to be in the Hindu name for the Pacific continent of Mu. Egyptian records state that the first Egyptians came from the Southern Sea in large sailing ships. The Southern Sea would be the Red Sea today, but 30,000 years ago, it probably was the Indian Ocean. It empties into the Indian Ocean that washes up on the western shores of Australia, the last remaining remnant of the third island continent of Mu today. In those days, Egypt was a fertile green Nile River valley, having much rain. Wherever the Nakals went, they built pyramids and temples and established knowledge among modern men that had previously dispersed earlier to many parts of the world. Historians will someday admit that civilization is thousands of years older than previously thought. Then they will have to acknowledge that men have been sailing and mapping the world's oceans for millennia. With travel comes colonization and established trade routes. It would seem that Lemuria was an idyllic civilization, but it wasn't. It was flawed in the Creator's eyes. The seed of man had been corrupted to the point that man had forgotten who his true Creator had been and acknowledged other gods. In God's eyes, this is the ultimate insult. The cataclysm of 9500 BC was sent by God to destroy the corrupted temporal earth. The fallen angels could see into the future with their seer stones and fled earth before the cataclysm, but most of their giant offspring were destroyed. Churchward states in his book The Lost Continent of Mu the following: The record of the destruction of Mu, the motherland of man, is a strange one indeed. From it we learn how the mystery of the white races in the South Sea Islands may be solved, and how a great civilization flourished in the mid-Pacific, and then was completely obliterated in almost a single night. The Nephilim were responsible for the horrible destruction of the motherland known as Mu. All that remains today are the volcanic mountaintops in the South Pacific and possibly Australia. The next chapter, The Lost Civilization of Atlantis, will describe some of the other colonies of Mu that existed before the cataclysm, and we'll learn how these lost civilizations continue to affect us even today.